This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. And today is a very special day. It's Veterans Day. It was established after the armistice at World War I. That was a temporary peace at the time, but that ended the conflict or the actual fighting. The armistice was formally signed on November 11th at 11 a.m., and since then, what started as Armistice Day or Remembrance Day became Veterans Day in the United States to honor veterans of all wars, and it's observed oftentimes with a moment of silence on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. So this is Veterans Day, and we're going to talk about Veterans Day from the perspective of some veterans, thanks to Telltale, Dakota Folklife and Stories, a project of the North Dakota Council on the Arts. Troy Geist is the state folklorist. He's been heavily involved in this project. And Troy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Could you give us a brief description of Telltale?
Well, Telltale is a project that we work with Dakota Legacy on, and that is a project that seeks to document the folk life and folk traditions of our state and of our region by focusing on elders, especially elders in long-term care facilities or other types of care facilities in our state.
Dave Swenson is the founder and producer at Makoche Studios in Bismarck, and he joins us as well to talk about this because, Dave, you've been heavily involved in this project.
Yes, and thanks for having us back. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Doug.
So you take the microphone to these senior retirement homes and let people tell you what their stories are. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. In a nutshell, Troy has been the organizer for all of this, and I'm so grateful to be a part of it. But it's really an exercise in listening. And so often when you sit down and talk to elders, once they acknowledge that you, in fact, are interested and you're there to listen, the stories really come.
Troy, what happens with all of these recordings? Because you don't use them all necessarily in these individual stories that are available online at the website for the North Dakota Council on the Arts. Are these somehow preserved for posterity?
Well, this project really has two functions. One is to make these materials more widely available for educational purposes, statewide and region-wide. So they're available on our website, but also will be available as podcasts on Prairie Public. But the other aspect of this, it's the process with which we do the recordings and the interviews as a way to bring the elders together to talk about things that they hold in common to help address this sense of loneliness and sense of isolation that elders feel sometimes in care facilities. And it helps spark connections between the elders and their family members as well, with the goal of really trying to improve their emotional and physical health. So there's two main goals of this project.
So they get some good out of it, and the rest of us get to hear these very interesting stories. Dave, explain the creative process of taking all these raw interviews and assembling them as stories, you know, with beginnings and middles and ends.
Well, anyone who's had some experience in audio broadcast, it's really what you do, Doug. It's storytelling. And you get as much as you can, and then you distill it down so that the story comes through clear, and that you're using great caution to make sure that you don't add or subtract. But so oftentimes, the actual stories themselves are so much more compelling than, say, any writer could come up with. So, again, it's a matter of listening and then distilling these stories down to their essence.
And because this is Veterans Day, we were interested, of course, in finding some stories that relate to the experience of our veterans. And one of the stories, Dave, is Discharged. This is John Gilbert's story, and you narrate it. Where was John Gilbert from?
Hines, Minnesota, a little town people go, Hines, where's that? And I say, well, it's near Black Duck. And they say, well, where's that? And I say, north of Bemidji. And then they kind of know. But he was born on a farm in Hines, Minnesota.
How did you find him? I mean, you ended up, he was in a nursing home or something like that. And how old is he, or is he still with us?
Full disclosure, John Gilbert is actually John Gilbert Swenson, who happens to be my father.
Very good.
So I knew this story, and I talked to Troy and said, you know, would it be all right if I interviewed my father? I think and Troy said, of course. So I did. And, you know, it's different when you talk to a parent or a relative and you swap stories, but it's one thing, and it's good fun and important to do. But when you put a microphone down in front of a parent or a relative, something changes. You know, it becomes permanent. And so I got the story from John Gilbert, Jack, as he was known, in a different way. He kind of put on his reporter hat. He was a very interesting guy. He was the first broadcaster on television in Bismarck, TV in 53 at KFYR. So he had a long career in broadcasting.
Well, this is a fascinating story, and it reminds us that, you know, lots of veterans have stories. Some of them shared them. Some of them didn't. I remember my youngest brother once asked my dad what he did in the war, and he mulled it over, and he wrote an essay, a long essay, detailed one, that he gave to each of us one Christmas, and it's the most wonderful thing. I wish I had a recording of him talking about it, but that's a regret I guess I'll live with.
That's really precious. That's a great memory, and you know, so doing what I do and doing what you do now, I looked at it that way. I wanted to be able to get a bit more of a permanent record, and because he was my father, and we lost him almost 2 years ago in December, I had this opportunity to do what you just said you wish you had. So it was a great event for me, and kind of a nice sidebar to this terrific project that we did with Troy.
I'd like to tag on with what David had just said when he talked about his experience with his father and how it becomes permanent. This effort really, you know, we talk about the impact with the elders, and it's substantial, but it's also very much has an impact on the elders' families. And this project and this effort really does reach many people besides those individual elders.
I could interject that, you know, this first batch of Telltale that we produced was sort of all over the map. We, you know, we talked about weather, we talked about homesteading, we talked about moonshiners, we talked about all sorts of things. And it just so happened that we did end up with a couple of veterans. But Troy is right now putting together a much larger project based on strictly on veteran stories. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Well, let's listen to this story now. It's Discharged. It's John Gilbert Swenson's story, narrated by his son, Dave Swenson. And let me tell you, this story ends with a twist.
John Gilbert grew up on a farm, but his heart really wasn't in it. He had bigger dreams. He and his brother and sister did their best to help out on their family's small farm, but he never really settled into it.
I never got used to getting up at 6 in the morning and getting out to milk cows and that sort of thing. And I wouldn't call them fond memories. When a cow kicks and you wind up landing in the gutter with fresh cow poop all over, it wasn't so bad in the wintertime when you could wipe it off your boots. But in the summertime, when you started out barefoot, it wasn't particularly pleasant. I had bigger dreams of what I wanted to do, who I wanted to be.
John's bigger dreams were fueled by the radio, a recent addition to the farm.
In those days, there was Morgan Beatty and Edward R. Murrow, and Elmer Davis did a five-minute newscast in the evening. I believe it was on CBS. He was well-known and well-respected and very accurate. And when he quoted Adolf Hitler as making a speech, you knew that Adolf Hitler had said just exactly that.
He listened to their radio every day that he could, and it defined what his bigger dream was.
I wanted to be a foreign correspondent. That was my early dream, and a very serious one.
His dream of becoming a newsman was so strong that at age 16, after graduating from high school a year early, he left home. He knew his father would try to talk him out of it, so
I ran away from home, and I did it with a little money that I'd gotten in graduation presents. But I remember that night going to bed and thinking, I don't want to be a farm boy. I just wanted to get out in the world and be something else. And so I slipped out of bed and out of my pajamas and got clothes on and packed a little suitcase that it was just a cardboard suitcase, but I got a few clothes in it and very quietly opened the bedroom window and dropped 10 or 12 feet down to the ground and took off. Caught that night train. I had to do it, and I knew that Dad wouldn't approve of my leaving at all.
John made his way to Minneapolis, and he found a job as an office boy at the Minneapolis Star Journal Tribune. He continued working in the newsrooms until
I was drafted. I was drafted in 44, went into service in 45. I volunteered to serve in the submarine.
But the Navy had other plans for him. John's experience in newsrooms left him with a valuable skill.
I'd been in newspapering. I'd taught myself to type, and I was pretty good at it. So I was assigned to type discharge papers.
John was sent to Boston, to the 9-story Fargo building, to work on the biggest job the Navy had facing them in the coming post-World War II era, that of the demobilization of the armed forces and discharging the millions of sailors who would soon be returning to civilian life. Like all those working at the Fargo building, John didn't just take numbers and sign forms. They all wrote personal stories about each individual and then sent them on as press releases to be published in local papers.
We had to write at least a couple of paragraphs on every man we discharged. We had to get to know the individual in a couple of minutes. Once in a while, it would be an interesting fellow.
There were many unique and interesting stories. But one day, a name on a form made him do a double take. The name was
William Patrick Hitler. That last name is, of course, going to arouse some attention. I looked up when he told me his name, and after inviting him to take a seat, he looked at me and very plain forward, said, he's my uncle. He was serving as a medic in the Navy. He and his mother had come to this country, apparently with Hitler's permission. They were both happy to be here. And that's when I knew I had a story.
After John himself was discharged from the Navy, he went back to working as a journalist for several decades. But he never did get overseas, and he never served on a submarine. And as he learned years later while taking a tour of the submarine Nautilus,
the fact is that I wouldn't have served very well on a submarine because I was claustrophobic.
Wow. That's a great story, Dave. How old was your father when he passed?
92.
Because most of our World War II veterans are gone, and our Korean and Vietnam vets are diminishing quickly as well. The story touches on something that is important to remember. World War II took place when the United States was, you know, called the melting pot of the world. It was well known that it included people from all corners of Earth, including, of course, Germans, lots of them in Minnesota and North Dakota, and Japanese, families who were in the war zones. And this next story, Hiroshima, is the title of it, and you can find it at nd.gov/arts. These are telltales. And this one tells a fascinating story, Dave, but I'm not sure that we don't know who this person is. This is anonymous. I mean, somebody knows, obviously, but he's not identified.
No, and not in the story, and sort of with intent, although I'm certain I could have.
Well, this reminds us of how World War II ended in the Pacific Theater, and that is with atomic bombs that were dropped, the only atomic bombs ever dropped in warfare, on Japan. The first in Hiroshima was uranium, the second in Nagasaki was plutonium, and the person who tells this story was in both places.
I went to Hiroshima about 8 weeks after the atomic bomb was dropped. I was a member of the 136th Regimental Combat Team and the INR Platoon, which is Intelligence Recon, and I was in the South Pacific, and we arrived in Japan on September 2nd at Kobe, and we moved on up to the Otsu Boys Training School, which was on Lake Biwako, and it had been an air seaplane base. And when we went through the gates, it was kind of interesting because the Japanese guards and the guard houses at the gates to the camp were still armed as we came through the gates, and they saluted as we came in. And, of course, as soon as we moved in, they were relieved immediately, and their arms, of course, were taken away. In our unit, we had two Nisi fellows. One of them had relatives at Hiroshima. And after we landed in Japan, Kit Yamamoto wanted to go down to Hiroshima to see his aunt and a cousin and ask if I wanted to go along. So I did. It was absolutely amazing. The streetcar was wheels were welded to the rails. There was a humongous ice, it looked like a big ice cube, brown ice cube. We thought it was a brewery, but at least it was a bottling company. And the building was gone, but the bottles had all melted in one huge, big pile of, looked like an iceberg. And we walked up to it, and we could see bubbles and stuff where the air or liquid was in the bottle, had been in the bottles. And like I said, the wheels of the streetcar were welded to the rails, and iron bars on the windows to keep people from sticking their arms out were there, but they had bones that were stuck to them where people either tried to get out or whatever, I don't know. But there were pieces of bone stuck to the iron bars in the windows in the streetcars. Looking for Kit's aunt and family, they lived on the outskirts of Hiroshima, and it was kind of up on the side of the I wouldn't call it a mountain, but it was higher elevation than the city was. And we went out there, and we found her, and she was fine, but she said that her son had gone into town the day of the bomb was dropped, and he didn't come home. So she went looking for him the next day, and she found him in a survivor's assembly where they were treating people, and he was in a daze. But other than that, he seemed to be all right. So she took him home. And about the second or third day that he was home, all of a sudden his gums started to bleed around his teeth. And then the next thing, he had blood, tears coming out of his eyes. and out of his ears, and the next day he died. But she also explained that after the bomb had gone off, about 20 minutes or so later, at her house up on the side of the hill, why, there were two evergreen bushes, decorative bushes, in her front yard. And she said that 15, 20 minutes after the bomb went off, why, those two bushes burst into flame. And they had been very, very green, healthy bushes. There were so many things that were weird about it. One of the things about my own personal happening after I had been there, probably it was a month or so, or maybe, I don't know, maybe 2 months even, but on the way later, after I had been down there, I was in the shower, in the gang shower, and one of the guys looked over and said, "Hey, what happened to your big toenail there?" And I looked down and it was gone. And so I hadn't even noticed it. So I checked my socks, and sure enough, there was my toenail. And within about a week, all of my toenails fell out. And the doctors at the Tokyo General Hospital, the 42nd General Hospital, couldn't figure out what caused it. And finally, I told them I'd been at Hiroshima and Nagasaki both. And they said it must have been from walking around in the from radiation, yeah, in the two cities. But I haven't had any problems with it since, and my toenails did grow back. But I've never had any other illness from it or anything. There were so many things about it, even the ghostly impressions of where people had been standing when the bomb went off, and that was just like an etching or a shadow burned into the whatever they were standing next to or sitting next to or whatever, which was kind of ghostly. It, like I said, in the streetcars, still there with images of people sitting there, but they were not there. They just weren't there. When I went back 5 years later, right at the around the epicenter of the bombing, at the ruins of the city hall or whatever the building is, at the big dome, the structure is still there. The skeleton of it is, but it's the yard is all nothing but flowers, just beautiful flower garden flowers. I was 18 years old when I went to Hiroshima. Yeah, I was 18.
Troy, reminder that troops didn't just encounter dangers in battle. Sometimes it was after the battle and where they went. You're still looking for stories, aren't you?
We have really been working right now currently with two places, one in Valley City and one in Lakota, elder care facilities right now. And that project involves a larger effort, which involves poetry, photography, audio recordings, of which we'll be working with Dave and Dakota Legacy to do. And then we're going to bring all those things together to create an exhibit. But with the advent of the pandemic, COVID-19, there's been a lot of challenges with the quarantine and the heroic efforts really of staff in those facilities to keep our elders safe. But that has slowed down our effort. But we're still trying to move along, and we hope and intend to try to make this an ongoing component of our Art for Life program.
Troy Geist is state folklorist. He's with the North Dakota Council on the Arts. And Dave Swenson is the founder and producer at Makoche Studios in Bismarck. Coming up on Main Street, Troy and Dave will stay with us to talk about another project involving veterans. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. COVID-19 is taking a heavy toll on North Dakota. With the election out of the way, some hoped that politics might be taking out of debating the state's response, but the disagreements continue. Newly reelected Governor Doug Burgum has been outspoken about encouraging people to wear masks to help stop community spread, but is not issuing a statewide mandate. Landis Larson of the North Dakota AFL-CIO says a mandate would not only protect frontline workers from infection, but also from having to enforce orders issued by their employer or municipality.
You know, a lot of cities have made mask mandates with no penalty. Well, there's the people that end up enforcing it, or trying to, are those frontline people.
Jason Boynton is a math professor and activist with North Dakota United. He says he feels Burgum has been in a tough position, having to govern people who take the virus seriously, as well as those who think the crisis is overblown. With the election cycle out of the way, he hopes the governor might feel less restraint to make bold decisions.
I hope that he can try, and I hope that he can institute a mandate that's got some teeth to it.
Boynton feels having a statewide mandate instead of a patchwork of local ordinances would create less confusion and might get more people to comply. As the pandemic worsens, the Fargo School District is finding substitute teachers to replace teachers who have tested positive has become more difficult. There is talk that Fargo schools may have to switch to distance learning as a result of the shortages if community spread is not contained. While data shows the schools are a safe place, the community rate is spiking so much it is significantly impacting staff absenteeism as teachers are quarantined. Nearly 100 teachers were out last week over the past 2 weeks. At least three schools were on the verge of switching to virtual learning because substitute teachers could not be found. School Board Vice President Robin Nelson put out a plea to the public.
We need some help, community. It's not happening. The defiance on or complete denial of COVID is really hurting us, and that is what is preventing our kids from being in school. I'm sorry I'm lecturing here, but it's really frustrating to be pressured by parents to get our kids back in school, and those same parents are fighting mask mandates.
Friday, local health officials will meet with school leaders to discuss possible options to solve the problem. And with less than 10% of the crop remaining in the field, North Dakota corn growers are enjoying a much-needed break this growing season. The latest numbers from USDA shows 93% of this year's crop has been harvested. That's a sharp contrast to last year when 14% of the crop was harvested before an early winter storm shut down or complicated the harvest. Brenda Elmer is executive director of the North Dakota Corn Growers. She says the optimism is there despite a significant amount of prevent plant acres.
I think nationwide about a third of the prevent plant was in North Dakota this year, so it is significant. But for what corn they did get in, I'm hearing from most of the growers that, you know, it's some of the best they've had.
Elmer says many of those prevent plant acres stemmed from the fact many growers were still harvesting the 2019 crop into May or even June of this year. She says USDA has projected a 37% decline in corn production this year, with corn produced for grain is expected to be down by nearly 2 million acres. Elmer says the demand for corn by China has helped boost the market for corn, but the reduced acreage is also creating some competition for the crop.
You know, about half of our corn goes to the ethanol plants, and, you know, there's concern with the acreage being down, you know, that they're going to need nearly all of the production that went into the ground this year.
Elmer says North Dakota is currently ranked 11th in the nation when it comes to corn production. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
The pandemic has upended our domestic lives.
Because now you are cooking three meals and getting everybody online and trying to do your own work.
And couples are struggling with their new roles and with each other.
A lot of fighting, a lot of tears.
Adapting to a new reality on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. We're observing Veterans Day. We all have memories of perhaps parades in our youth. I can remember being a very young kid in Detroit Lakes, and Veterans Day parade would start at the GAR Monument, the Grand Army of the Republic, the Union soldiers who fought in the Civil War. That was north of the railroad tracks in downtown Detroit Lakes, and we'd walk down Washington Avenue to the park by the lake to hear speeches and patriotic music. There were, when I was a kid, still Spanish-American vets, lots of World War I vets at that time, actually, and of course, many, many, many World War II vets, because most of my friends and our family, of course, had veterans among them. So we're talking with Troy Geist. He's the state folklorist with the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and Dave Swenson, who is a collaborator with him on a project to collect the stories of our older residents in North Dakota and Minnesota. Dave Swenson is the founder and producer at Mokoche Studios in Bismarck. Troyd, you are also working on another kind of a poetry project, right? Can you describe that for us?
Yeah, we're working on a project involving veterans where we are helping them create poems based on their lives and then doing photography related to that and audio. That's where David Swenson and Dakota Legacy Mokoche Studio comes in. And then we're going to bring all those components together and create an exhibit to honor veterans and or the loved ones of those veterans.
So how do you create a poem with these people? How's that process work?
Well, there's a famous poem called I Am From, written by George L. Lyons, that basically is a template that anybody can use to create a poem that's very specific to that individual. And it's kind of an interview process, a reminiscing process, and the poem is created from that template.
So can you give us an example?
Yes. So one of the places we're working with is the Good Samaritan Center Care Facility in Lakota, North Dakota. And there's a poem. It's called I'm From Mom's Potato Pancakes by Marvin Ewert. The poem reads, I am from the newspaper and looking forward to it daily, from glasses for reading and a recliner. I'm from an older home with four bedrooms, beautiful stained oak and open stairs. I'm from the little garden. I'm from getting together for the holidays and living a long life, from Pauline and Frank and 13 siblings. I'm from breakfast in the morning and always oatmeal. I'm from working a lot. I'm from Thanksgiving, everyone with their own special place to sit, and country music. I'm from born on the farm near Drake, North Dakota, and German. Mom's potato pancakes and potato soup. From Dad, who came to the U.S. at 16, served in Cuba. A foot soldier under Teddy Roosevelt, Spanish-American War. I'm from the Army, Corporal, Fort Riley, Kansas, and Korea. A Silver Star, a Purple Heart, Dad's Spanish-American War uniform, kept near me and with my sister's family.
I'm from Mom's Potato Pancakes. The memories that, of course, we carry with us that have a special meaning. And I suppose if you're a veteran far from home, those potato pancakes would be particularly sweet in memory. Troyd, what kind of experience would people have as they go through this exhibit?
Well, I think this exhibit is really going to be powerful for the elders and for their family members. The poetry and the photography are going to be directly related. Things referenced in the poem will be featured in the photography, for instance. So with Marvin, whose poem we just read, can you imagine his father was in the Spanish-American War. He served under Teddy Roosevelt in Cuba. He himself received a Silver Star. This is a very, I mean, what an honor. Yet this guy is very quiet about it. He received a Purple Heart. So for him to tell this story, he will be visiting with David and doing interviews with David to tell the story about what garnered him the Silver Star, but also what he thinks is a higher honor, and that is the Purple Heart. To bring all of this together, visually, in text, and then in the audio that people can listen to in their own words, it's going to be a very personal exhibit. It's going to really strike a lot of people. And there are people like this all over our state who have these, as I said earlier, these amazing stories. And I really do think that these things become legacy keepsakes for the family. I mentioned earlier that this project has slowed down in a couple of our places because of COVID-19. And when we started this project, some of the elders originally involved in it have since passed, not from COVID-19, but from other things. Other elders are being impacted because of the stress of the quarantine. At one of our sites, one of the veterans who wrote a poem passed away. And at the military pinning ceremony, the activity coordinator read that man's poem to the family at that funeral. Mm-hmm. So they become extremely important and powerful keepsakes for the family.
Dave, Troy mentioned your participation in this part of the project as well. Can you describe what you're doing?
Well, as Troy said, things have changed since the pandemic. It used to be great fun to be able to go to the different long-term care facilities, and often I would sit down at a table with three or four individuals, which is a challenge, you know, to record all of those conversations at once. But each of the participants would sort of spur on the conversation for the others. Now, of course, because of the pandemic, we don't want to be going in or out of these long-term care facilities. As you, I'm sure, know, they've been hit tremendously hard by COVID-19. And so a lot of it has to be done virtually, which is a disappointment. But at the same time, you get those one-on-one interactions. I know the first one of these I did was supposed to be a 15-20 minute conversation. And, you know, at somewhere over an hour, I finally apologized to the caregiver there and said, you know, I didn't know this was going to go this long. I didn't mean to take so much of your time. And she was saying, you know, this is great to watch the participant light up and how important it was to them and how much they enjoyed the conversation. So there's both good and bad that comes out of it, but I hope that answers your question in sort of a roundabout way.
It does. I think there's some therapy in this kind of conversation when people are so isolated and you come in from the outside and engage them in their memories.
Therapy not only for those who are granting us the interviews, but therapy for those of us who are doing the interviewing. It's really transformative to sit and listen to all these elders, these people with such vast experience and knowledge and understanding. You know, you get over the age of 60 and you begin to realize how little you knew when you were 30, even though you thought you did. There are some advantages to age.
Troy, do you have another poem for us?
We do have another poem. As I said earlier, we wanted to include also some of the close family members of veterans because their lives are impacted too by that service. Their lives are identified by that service of their loved ones. So this poem is also from a person at the Good Samaritan Center. They're in Lakota, North Dakota. And the poem is called "I'm From the Queen Mary." And it's by Raydene Wenige. Her poem goes, "I am from flower pots and grandmother's greenhouse, from soap and eyeglasses. I'm from the three-bedroom, one-story home, smells like flowers, feels like home. I'm from the grass, the red geraniums, grown by grandma, I, the chief waterer. I'm from Christmas pudding and blue eyes, from Emily and Raymond. I'm from a small family and only child. I'm from green thumbs. I'm from sit up straight and be good and American big band music. I'm from celebrating Boxing Day. I'm from Berkshire, England, and 100% English. Toast and World War II food ration books. From a bunker and air raid sirens blaring. A war bride to America on the Queen Mary. I'm from my husband Ernest, an army medic, stationed in England, shipped to France. My original wedding ring picked out myself, worn out, replaced with a new one on my finger."
My late Aunt Betty Hamilton was born and raised in Scotland. She was a nurse in Greenock, Scotland, during the Second World War when it was being bombed, and she met her husband, my uncle Art, who was an ambulance driver. And many years after the war, she prized saving up all her money over many, many years to buy passage on the Queen Mary to go back to Scotland to visit her brother Angus. This is wow. Evocative. You're right. It's therapeutic.
It is. And these,
it
these
is.
Things, yeah. You know, the poem both by Radine and Marvin, you can hear the little glimpses of what they went through, which are amazing experiences. And now for David to be able to pull more of that information out and shape it into these fuller stories in audio, it's just going to be a wonderful project. And it's a great way to honor our veterans and the families that have given so much.
Again, you can find a lot of this information and the ongoing project at nd.gov/arts. It strikes me, gentlemen, that this is like a book, that maybe this should be between covers, too.
You know, I never thought about that, but it certainly could be.
I can hear the wheels turning already in your head, right? You know, I would share one other thing, if I might. And that's a good friend that I had, Art Dell, who years ago we met on a regular basis, and he's no longer with us. But he and I had just gone through a time of tremendous personal loss in both of our lives, and we were sort of sitting around commiserating, talking about it, And he said to me something to the effect of, you know, we're not unique. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, you can walk up and down this street and knock on any door, and there's a tragedy behind it. And, you know, maybe that's a bit dark, but the point was well made in that there are stories like this behind every door you knock on if you ask and you listen. And not to wax too poetic here, but... You know, maybe that's a key to the trying times that we live in. If we just take time to listen to one another, the stories are there, and there's a lot of shared experiences.
I think that's a key element of a lesson for all of us. We are oftentimes too willing to basically share our opinion, especially in hyper-partisan times. And frankly, there's a lot of value to just listening to why somebody thinks as they do, or for that matter, the history we all have lived and the stories we all have, to think about them and maybe share them because somebody else might want to know.
Well, they're helpful because talking with many of these elders, you hear about the tough times that they have gone through, and we are, of course, going through tough times, but they're often here to remind us, and they do, that we've been through tough times. We got through that. We can get through this. I just would like to say, if people can, during Veterans Day, but also with the holidays approaching, you know, reaching out somehow, interacting somehow with our elders and especially those in our care facilities would be a great way to give back and to help those who are under enormous stress right now. Whether it's going and singing a song outside their window or painting a beautiful image on the outside of the window or sending a note, we need to think about them during this time of celebration.
Troy Geist is state folklorist. He's with the North Dakota Council on the Arts. And Dave Swenson is the founder and producer at Makoche Studios in Bismarck. Gentlemen, thanks for spending time with us today.
My pleasure. And this being Veterans Day, we should all take a moment. You know, you hear these stories and realize how much is out there that maybe is left unsaid. But we need to remember that it's there, and how much we owe to these brave men and women who have served the nation.
And efforts like this and that need to listen, as David mentioned earlier, is so important. There are these amazing stories and amazing people out there who have lived these amazing times, but they don't talk about it. And these kind of efforts really can serve as an emotional catharsis for people who went through this, but also help bring them closer to their own families to reveal things that their own children may not have heard the whole story.
And Doug, thanks so much for calling attention to it.
Well, we'll have much more of those Telltale, the Dakota Folk Life and Stories. It's a wonderful project, and we're pleased to have it on Main Street.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura has been a familiar voice on our network for a long time. He taught college biology for many years. He remains a naturalist with a keen interest in the plants and animals of our region. Today, his subject is antlers.
Deer gun season started Friday. No doubt antlers will be the topic of much conversation, some of it even true, whether it's about the one that got away or what have you. Most of those conversations will be on the size of the antlers or whether they were typical or atypical. But there are other aspects to antlers that we give scant attention. I was reminded of that recently when I ran across an online Smithsonian article about antler development from 2017. Antlers develop from short pedicels or stalks on the frontal bone of the skull. Growth is rapid, very rapid. If the buck's health and nutrition are excellent, the antlers may grow up to 3/4 of an inch per day. Then, as autumn approaches, the antlers begin to harden, and the outer covering of velvet that has brought blood and nutrients to the developing antler dries up and is shed. Antler size and form is a function of genetics, age, nutrition, and more. The growth, of course, is a highly regulated process influenced by hormones, photoperiod, and other factors. It all makes me think of Senator Proxmire. Some of you may remember Senator William Proxmire and his Golden Fleece Awards, largely a media ploy, given to projects he considered to be a waste of taxpayer dollars. I suspect he might have considered giving the award to a government-funded study of antler growth. I can just about hear the clamor now. But like many scientific studies that appear to be purely academic and have little, if any, practical value, gaining a better understanding of antler growth may provide important information for medical applications. Already it's been discovered that the cells responsible for antler growth can be moved to another part of the deer's skull and begin to form an antler. And because antlers have neurons that have been shown to regenerate 10 times faster than human neurons, a better understanding of how antler growth may have applicability in healing wounds, treating paralysis, and perhaps even limb regeneration. So as you hear all that talk over the next couple weeks about those trophy antlers, give some thought as to how better understanding of antler growth may have some amazing medical applicability to improve the human condition. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 11th. On this date in 1950, the results of the Sears Roebuck Safety Slogan Contest in Bismarck were in. The winner was a 10-year-old from Fort Lincoln for his slogan, Go Slow or You'll Go Fast. His award was a gold-colored statue of Roy Rogers' horse, Trigger. Young Larry Roy Amon took possession of his prize that night when Roy Rogers himself gave it to him on stage. Rogers and his wife, Dale Evans, were in Bismarck as part of a tour with their cowboy band. The Bismarck Tribune wrote, "Roy Rogers is king of the cowboys, and Western fans couldn't have found a more gracious, friendly, down-to-earth ruler for their sovereign." For young Larry, the highlight of the evening was sitting, for a good 10 minutes, in Roy Rogers' saddle on the real Trigger. The story read, "The Wonder Horse did not attempt any of his famous tricks for the young horseman's benefit. Trigger was well-behaved, considering the noise and excitement around him." Larry wasn't the only youngster involved with the event. The Tribune chose two special reporters to conduct an interview with the Western duo, seventh graders Jeannie Lewis, who had just moved from Mott to Bismarck, and Billy Russell of Mandan. The young reporters questioned Dale and Roy before the show, with Billy asking the first question, "Have you ever been on television?" Roy said he was still under movie and radio contracts and had appeared on TV only a few times. He forecast, however, that someday he'd be a regular television performer. Billy asked Rogers if he had ever performed in the Mandan Rodeo. Rogers replied, "No, I haven't, but I would like to sometime." The young reporters learned Rogers' tour got off to a rocky start. Outside of St. Joseph, Missouri, a wheel came off Rogers' trailer, and his prize dog, Bullet, was injured. Bullet had to be left with a veterinarian, but seemed to be recovering. Jeannie asked Dale if she liked to cook. Dale said, "She certainly did." And Billy jumped in asking, "Roy, what dish of Dale's do you like best?" "Fried chicken and cornbread," said Roy. "She can really cook them." Then as the band struck up their opening number, the interview was over. Roy and Dale walked out on stage to entertain an audience of some 3,000 adoring North Dakota fans. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today, and whether you follow us online or listen to our broadcast, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Anytime you want to hear a Main Street show, you can tune it in as an archive podcast at prairiepublic.org. Thursday on our show, Jack Zaleski is the former editorial page editor for The Forum and the author of the new book, Forum Communications Company, A Narrative History, 1980 to 2018, which updates a history that started in 1878. And Sue Balcom will join us for another episode of Main Street Eats. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.